and welcome to Always Take Notes.
A message from our sponsor, Arvon. Do you have a story in you? Or want to test the waters of writing poetry or non-fiction? Maybe you already write and write well, but would like to try a new form or genre, pick up some new tricks.
Enter Arvon. Arvon run a yearly program of in-person and online events, from five-day residential writing weeks that take place at one of their three writing houses, to pay-what-you-can online events and online masterclasses that delve deep into craft over the course of 2 hours. Their courses cover everything from commercial, genre, and experimental fiction to poetry, screenwriting, and even songwriting.
They've been running creative writing courses up and down the UK since 1968. In that time, their prize-winning tutors, many of whom may be some of your favourite writers, have unlocked the creativity of over 100,000 people. Many have gone on to be published authors and career writers themselves.
But actually, it's not about that. Writing with Arvon is about finding a supportive community of fellow writers, making like-minded connections that last a lifetime. By signing up for a course, you don't just get an acclaimed author as your tutor. You also gain a writing group to bounce ideas off long after the course is finished.
So whether it's a cosy stay at one of their writing houses in Devon, West Yorkshire, or sleepy Shropshire, or a course you can do from the comfort of your sofa, Arvon works around your creative life.
Visit arvon.org/courses. That's arvon.org/courses to learn more and give yourself the gift of writing.
Hello and welcome to Always Take Notes. In this episode, Rachel and myself spoke with the novelist and short story writer, Jhumpa Lahiri.
We spoke to Jhumpa about winning the Pulitzer Prize with her first published book, learning and eventually writing in Italian, and her latest book of short fiction, Roman Stories.
It's a great episode and we hope you enjoy it. Jhumpa, welcome to Always Take Notes. It's excellent to have on the show. We wanted to start with the new book, Roman Stories, and we were wondering if you could explain where this fits into this huge project you've had of learning Italian, both as a language to be able to read and speak, but ultimately as a language to write in. We saw that it was originally written in Italian and then jointly translated back into English. So where does it fit into that, you know, part of your writing life?
It's the most recent iteration of a new chapter, shall we say, of my creative journey, a new chapter in a new language and largely inspired by a new place and informed by a new perspective, a profoundly new perspective, I would say, because writing in another language involves also thinking for me in another language and processing, observing things in a different, with another, an entirely different sensibility. And so this book, this is the fifth of my books written directly in Italian. And it has its place because, you know, it's sort of part of this current moment that I'm in, you know, growing from book to book. But I've always been growing from book to book from the very beginning.
I saw you describe learning Italian as relearning how to think. So how do those cognitive processes differ on a practical level?
Well, it's really the question, I would say, it's processing, how to process sensation, experience, reality, using other words and allowing those words to represent aforementioned feelings, experiences, impressions. I think that's the difference, and they sit differently inside of me when they're in another language. And I've always been aware of this because I was raised with two languages. And so Bengali sat in a certain way inside of me and seemed to correspond to a certain reality, and English sat differently inside of me and corresponded and continues to correspond to another reality.
And the title of your new book nods to Alberto Moravia, an Italian journalist and novelist who published his own set of Roman stories in the 1950s. To what extent was this a kind of conscious act of homage with this book?
It was fully conscious. It was very much a salute to Moravia and his, well, his extraordinary example of using short stories, using the short form to narrate an inherently unnarratable city, which is Rome. It's very difficult to explain Rome or to really describe Rome in a satisfying way. And I think that short stories are ideal because they give you a multifaceted approach and effect, right? And he does this. He does this across over 200 stories that he writes in the 1950s, he calls them his racconti romani, but they were published. They were published, you know, in newspapers weekly. And he writes about, largely, he writes about characters in post-war Italy during the economic boom. But these are characters who are not faring particularly well. These are characters who are frequently quite lost, who are living on the edges, who are desperate, who are not quite riding the wave of the historical moment. So I found his title and the nature of his Roman stories relevant to what I was exploring in my own stories, because they too are set in the city and are exploring characters who feel on the outside of things. And, you know, Moravia's great theme was alienation. And you see that from his very first novel, L'Indifferenti, and forward. And he's always writing about distances, about silences, about communication breakdowns, about things of that nature. And I think I, to some degree, have been as well, you know. And so I thought he was very relevant from that point of view. I also am so personally indebted to Moravia as a reader and a writer. I mean, he was the first Italian writer I felt that I could really read in Italian and fully engage with and understand, and the sense of reading in another language began to fall away as I read Moravia. He came, I engaged with him in the right moment in Italian. I had already read his work in English years and years ago, but to rediscover him in Italian had a huge impact on my Italian and also sort of reawakening certain approaches to writing.
Were you similarly led by character then when coming up with the ideas for these stories, or was it a slightly different process or inspiration behind many of them?
I maybe sometimes there were characters who came to mind and I wanted to follow them and understand what was going on with them. Other times it might be a situation, or in the case of the central story in the collection, the steps or the staircase, you know, it's a physical setting that then generates the narrative and the characters.
I wanted to ask about this trait of not using names for characters. So I was struck by this when I read Peace Parties in the New Yorker earlier this year. And I saw elsewhere that you've referred to this as a kind of way to strip back, to reduce some of the baggage that comes with names. Could you talk a bit about your intention with that?
It's just as you said, it's to open up the reader's ability to read the character without quickly and conveniently drawing a line between any given character and the point of origin, the provenance of the character. And I think in particular in this collection, in which I'm really suggesting the idea that we are all foreigners, that, you know, the native foreign binary has to be, isn't as simple as that, and it's always a shifting question, and that, you know, depending on where we go in the world, we can quickly go from being quote-unquote native to quote-unquote foreigner. Because all of the characters in this book, even those who are, you know, presumably Roman in that they're born and raised and have always lived in the city, some of them feel on the outside. In fact, some of them are the children of immigrants who are born and raised and have known nothing but Rome. but still feel very much on the outside of things. So there is, I think, you know, keeping the names out of it, I feel, allows the reader to have a richer understanding of who they are as characters, as people. This is a trait, if you will, this is a choice from the beginning in all of my Italian writing. I have not named the characters in anything. I've written in Italian and I haven't really named places until now. This is the first time I've put the word Rome very emphatically used it as a title and referred to it here and there in the stories themselves. But I think, you know, I mean, when I started writing in Italian, I was thinking about other kinds of examples. And so, you know, I mean, if you think about a writer like Calvino, who writes that amazing collection, Difficult Loves, and their stories, you know, Adventure of a Soldier, Adventure of a Bather, Adventure of a Reader. So it's more the quality of the character and not the name of the character who's driving our understanding of who the character is. So I was influenced by other kinds of approaches to writing. And I'm certainly not the first writer to withhold names in that sense from a piece of fiction. And there's so many examples. I mean, Calvino is one. Kafka, you know, famously withheld names, used initials for his works. And so perhaps it's more of a European tradition, but also more of a, you know, going back to fables and myth and that older types of storytelling in which, you know, there's something more important going on than the name of the character. I mean, I think names are sort of almost a modern, more modern invention. Though, of course, there are names all over the place. I'm now translating Ovid's Metamorphoses, and it's full of names. The ancient world is full of names as well. But there's an abstraction that is possible when we take names away. And there's a more nuanced understanding of identity. Or conversely, I would say, we can suspend more predictable questions about identity as we're reading.
Is it that you have a sense of them in your head and you just don't use them in the telling? Or do you also not imagine them with names, you know, during the creative process?
I don't imagine the names. I withhold them from myself.
We wanted to come back to the new book later on, but could we roll back now to your early life and perhaps tracing this idea of kind of existing between languages? We saw that Bengali is your mother tongue, but you don't speak it perfectly. You're not a reader and writer of that. Could you tell us a bit about, you know, your experience growing up in this interlingual world and how that, you know, you think contributed to the kind of writer you later became?
I grew up in a somewhat charged interlingual world in that, you know, English was the language of other people. English was not our language in the world of my upbringing, in the family, in the home. English was the language. I mean, I was born in London, but really my earliest memories only begin in the United States. I was very young when my family moved here. And English was a language that one did not trust. English was a language that, as I said, those other people spoke, and those other people didn't understand us. Those other people didn't necessarily like us. So English was a language I was quite apprehensive about when I was young. And at the same time, I was expected to learn it, and I had to learn it in order to assimilate to this culture and to survive in this culture, to go to school and to socialize and those things. So, I mean, I think this is an experience. I'm describing an experience that's relatively common in immigrant families. I think in my case, it was particularly charged because, you know, my mother was very insistent on maintaining her identity, her Bengali identity, in a place, in a world, in an historical moment in which there was no place. There was no place for a Bengali family to be living in a provincial town, in small town, university town in the United States in the 1970s. So it's the lack of place, acknowledgement, any any reverberation of who you are in the place where you're living that drives the added insistence on maintaining the language and everything that goes with it. So that was the context in which I was raised. It was a conflictual situation. I feel, you know, now looking back as an adult, and I felt incredibly, how can I put this? I mean, I felt that I was failing on both ends. I felt that I was failing because I spoke the language of my parents and was first loved and taken care of in and was living day to day in a language that I could speak well, but the older I got, the more the gap became clear that you know, my Bengali was only ever going to get to a certain level because I was not being educated in that language. I was not learning to read and write in that language. I was all of my language was coming from them and from their friends and relatives when we would go to Calcutta, this kind of thing. And so I felt that I was failing in my, you know, in being an imperfect speaker of my mother's language, my mother and father's language. And I also felt alienated from the English language for the reasons I've just mentioned, which is that, you know, it was, you know, clear from the very beginning that English was not my language, because the message was English is the language other people speak, but you have to learn how to speak it. And then, you know, when the older I get and the more I go to school and read and write and so forth, my English, of course, accelerates and becomes my dominant language. And there too, there are feelings of, you know, they're guilty feelings because I see how my parents are experiencing life in the United States and the discrimination they face, a lot of it based on how they speak, a lot of it based on what they sound like when we go out into public, when we're in English speaking contexts, right? And I see how they carry themselves. I see their own apprehension about speaking, about pronouncing things, about mispronouncing things. And I, of course, don't have that issue, right? Because I'm raised in a place where I learn the accent. I don't, you know, one doesn't hear the foreignness in the same way that one would hear it when my parents would speak. So it was very, very complex from the beginning and throughout my life.
When you were a child and you were reading books in English, did you find the experience of those also quite alienating? You know, I know you've talked about reading Little Women. You know, was it something that you felt didn't capture, it was something you couldn't really relate to or identify with?
No, I never thought that. I felt a bit of a guilty pleasure reading in English because I remember, you know, thinking that because I was raised in such a specific kind of world within a world, that a world that, as I said, had sort of zero to do with the outside world in which we lived in. I mean, this is a period of you know, life in the United States. There are no words like Indian American. There's no terminology. There's no understanding of where my family comes from. Nobody knows what Bengali is. Nobody knows where India is on a map. People think I'm Native American, you know, largely in schools. If I say I'm Indian, they assume I'm a Native American. That's what we're talking about. That was the reality I'm being raised in my childhood, you know, my early childhood, and which are the formative years. But when I was reading, no, I felt a guilty pleasure because I realized that reading was a portal to learn how other people, namely non, you know, Indian, non-Bengali people, lived their lives, how they sat at the table, what their rituals were, what things were important to them. Even in storybooks, I learned these things because they would be celebrating things. They would be, I don't know, blueberry picking or sailing in a sailboat or... Also, you know, I would see their homes, how people's homes looked in picture books or how they were described in other books, the fact that there was a fire roaring and, you know, the foods that were on the table. I mean, these were all so fundamentally different from the way I was being raised, the way my family's home looked, what the food that was on our table, the things that my parents were thinking about and talking about. There was a total disconnect, but I didn't feel, oh, I wanted to see myself or my own experiences. I never thought that. Because I found nevertheless that the stories, I found a place for myself as a reader in those stories. Reading came to give me the first sense of place that I had in life, because I'm raised in a household where our home is not home. The physical structure we're living in is not considered emotionally our residence, you know, and the most vital object in our home were the suitcases, you know, the suitcases that we would fill and take back to India. You know, that notion of, oh, we'll just be moving on, you know, soon this will end, soon this adventure will end and we'll be moving on. And that was the idea, I think that was the idea for much of my early childhood, that my father's experience or adventure in the United States as a scholar, as a librarian, this was all going, you know, naturally going to run its course, and that we would move back to India and to live there. And it was really only when, you know, my father worked at university, he received tenure, you know, so representing ongoing indefinite employment, and then they decided to buy a home as opposed to rent a home. And when that happened, when my parents decided to buy the home that they then lived in for many years, I remember it was a day of deep trauma for my mother. She was, you know, she was very visibly distraught that this was the case and what this represented for her future and for our future. Yeah.
We saw that you did 3 master's degrees and a doctorate when you were a young adult. What was the kind of plan, if there was one, of doing this plethora of studying?
I didn't really know what I was going to do. I didn't know what to do. As I said, I was raised in a university environment. I grew up around people who cared about education, were involved in education, who studied, who taught. And all I really knew how to do was read and think about books and, you know, do some writing about the books I read. That was the only thing I felt that I was moderately good at or capable of doing, or the only thing that I felt was sort of suited to me as a person. Everything else felt somehow forced and not the right fit. Yes, that was where I felt relatively comfortable. Okay, so sort of being in libraries, being in bookshops, reading mostly, thinking about what that meant, my literature courses. So I kept going and deepening my relationship to books and to reading. And I mean, there was also a familial expectation that I pursue the highest degree possible to receive, you know, the highest level of education possible. This was something my father had very much wanted to do, and that unfulfilled goal on his part was placed on me and eventually my sister. It was very important to him that we, given, you know, our opportunities, given the fact that we were free agents in a sense and weren't married with a small child to raise, could get PhDs, and so we got them.
With apologies for such a prosaic question, but how did you fund all that further study given the expense of education in the US?
I was given fellowship, so I didn't pay for anything.
And then could we talk now about your first publication, so Interpreter of Maladies in 2000? We really like on the podcast to talk to authors about how their first book came to be in terms of agents, deals and stuff like that. And we saw that you'd had a short story published in the New Yorker the year before that came out. So how did you move from this very academic environment to studying, publishing fiction?
Well, I mean, for most of my time after college, so my graduate school years in Boston, at Boston University, I was also writing on the side. And I had started writing for myself sort of after graduating from college, because I studied literature, I studied English, and I minored in classics in college. And I was very sort of focused on the reading of literature, studying literature. I was quite intimidated by the prospect of expressing myself creatively. I didn't know who I was still. I wouldn't have known where to begin. So I didn't. But after college, some space opened up, and I think it was because it was the first moment. I took, you know, a bit of a gap year, I suppose. I took some time off between finishing my undergraduate degree and beginning graduate school. And in that time, I moved to Boston. I was working in a bookshop, and then I had another job as a research assistant for an academic. And it was in that moment of kind of a neither here nor there, not doing anything in particular, not doing anything official, and especially not doing anything official in the eyes of my parents, who are very focused on what I was going to do, my intellectual trajectory, also my human trajectory, but my intellectual trajectory. So it was in this sort of gap period that I was able to allow myself to sort of go slowly, very hesitantly, creep toward the idea of writing for myself, using the language I had learned as a child, English, using this other language, the other people's language, to write things that weren't about Shakespeare or whomever, but to write something that was coming from within myself, shall we say. And this happens in that period. And so when I got to Boston University, the first year I received a fellowship to study English literature. And I did study English literature, but at the same time, I would pass the hallway where there was a creative writing program in the same building. And as a sort of, I remember sort of physically feeling the curiosity, the impulse to wander over to that part of the building, as opposed to going up to the fourth floor where all of my literature classes were being held. So that was a sign. And the second semester, I did take a course, a fiction writing course. I was able to sort of finagle my way in. I felt very much an imposter. I wasn't supposed to be taking those courses. I was supposed to be reading Faulkner and medieval literature and all of these other things. But at that point, something in me split. And I was, you know, the scholar, and I was also very slowly and hesitantly an aspiring writer. And so then the rest of the time that I'm getting, you know, I got my other degrees and I get my doctorate and I study Renaissance drama and so on and so forth, I was also accumulating short stories, but in a very kind of marginal way, you know, sort of when there was nothing else I needed to do, during the summers, during a break, always a kind of a guilty pleasure, because I knew that it wasn't the real thing I should have been doing. The real thing that I was doing was getting a doctorate. And I think this was good for me, because I felt that my writing, it always had to work against the current of all of the outward expectations of my life, and also my identity as a sense, because by the time I had accumulated enough stories to sort of dare call it a manuscript, maybe 5 people in the world knew that I spent time writing. Nobody, I never talked about it, I never told anybody, you know, apart from the people I'd studied with, 1 or 2 professors. I never, it was a part of me I never talked about, even with my closest friends or with my family, until I got to the point where I felt that I had enough material. And even then, you know, I would send my stories out and they would come back and they would, you know, some of them were published, most of them weren't, you know, there was that whole phase of testing the waters. And then, you know, there was a moment of great serendipity, a great fortune of receiving a fellowship after all of my academic fellowships, my academic work was ended. And most of the other people I was in the doctoral program with were applying naturally for jobs, teaching jobs, postdocs, what have you. And I felt that that was a very important fork in the road for me. And I decided not to apply for the next step of whatever happens if you're on a purely academic trajectory, and I applied for yet another fellowship, which I received, to a place called the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown in Cape Cod, Massachusetts. And I was incredibly lucky to get that. And so I was able to live in Provincetown, Massachusetts for 7 months and be supported both financially, very modestly, but it was enough. But more importantly, I was able to be supported psychically as an artist, something I had never dared call myself until that moment. And in those 7 months, so when I got there, I was 30 years old. I had just finished my dissertation. I remember had to sort of do the finishing touches on my dissertation, but I also had, I don't know, half a dozen or more, maybe a dozen short stories. And once some had been published, some others hadn't been published. But once I got into that environment, suddenly I was living with visual artists, poets, writers who were putting their energy into a completely different, you know, type of labor. And I realized for the first time, okay, this is who I am. I have found my people in some sense. I am an artist. It was transformative. It was utterly transformative for me because, you know, I mean, I remember reading, you know, Portrait of the Artist as a young man, Joyce. I remember reading that novel at 18 in college. And I remember feeling something very, it was like an earthquake when I read that book, because I think I intuited on some level that this is what I was, that I needed to do this somehow, but I had no idea at the moment, at that time, how to dare, right? When Joyce talks all about separation and the need for the artist to separate from one's place, from one's family, and in my case, eventually also from language. And so, you know, from I can now looking back, I can trace sort of key, you know, seminal moments in my life and my development as an artist. So certainly reading Joyce at 18, a moment, and then having this fellowship at the age of 30, having the time, having the space, being able to say to people who ask me, what are you doing with your life? What are you doing now? And I would say, I'm at this place where I'm being supported to work on my fiction writing for 7 months. And they would say, you write fiction? What? What's going on? I thought you were an academic. I thought you studied Shakespeare and Marlowe and people. So, you know, I mean, I think now that I'm older, I'm so grateful that I was able to do different things, because all of it fed me. All of it continues to feed me as a person and as a writer and as a scholar. And I have that side of myself as well. So there are no regrets.
We are thrilled to announce the publication of Always Take Notes, Advice from Some of the World's Greatest Writers. The book, edited by the two of us, features contributions from almost 100 past guests on the podcast. It's a distillation of the wit and wisdom we've heard over the past 6 years.
The book offers, we think, frank and entertaining guidance on writing in particular and living a creative life in general. It answers questions such as, where do the best ideas come from? How do you stay motivated? What does it take to become a published author? And how do you actually make money from your writing?
Published by Ithaca Press, Always Take Notes, Advice from Some of the World's Greatest Writers is available now in all good bookshops. We hope you enjoy reading it. And to pick up part of Simon's question there, how did you find your agent? And then if you could sort of walk us through the process of getting to the publication of Interpreter of Maladies.
Okay, so I had these stories. They had kind of piled up, and because I had published some of these stories in a few magazines here and there, once in a while a letter would come from an agent, a kind of, oh, I read your story in X magazine and I admired it, and you know, should you ever have a collection, and sort of these kind of letters of solicitation. And so I kept them, of course. I thought, oh, wow. And at the time I thought, oh, well, that's never going to happen, but okay, I'll just keep it in a little drawer or whatever. And then when I got to that point, I pulled out those letters and I wrote to those people and I met with them, and then it didn't work out. They looked at the manuscript, which was the kind of proto version of interpretive maladies. And they said, well, it's not really, I don't think this is the right thing yet. Maybe you should try writing a novel. You know, it's really hard to publish short stories. Surprise. Something I've been hearing now for the past 30 years, and it never goes away. So I thought, okay, well, I guess these stories aren't really suitable for publication. And with that in mind, when I went to Provincetown, yes, I went with this sheaf of papers that were the short stories I had written over the past 7 or 8 years, but I didn't really have very much faith in them. And I set myself to, you know, I thought, okay, well, now I have this opportunity. It's all very exciting. I'm going to try to write a novel. And so when I got there, I started to draft very early pages of the namesake because I didn't know what else to do. And I was just sort of trying things out. I was going here, going there in my, you know, in my mind thinking what, you know, now, so the agents don't want the stories, they want a novel. So, okay, let me try to sort of construct something on a larger canvas. And it was there that I met another agent. And because now I'm in a situation where it's all writers and artists, so, you know, agents would come through, they would come to the events, they would come to like the readings and things like that. So I met this new agent and she said, what do you have? You know, who are you? What do you have? And I said, oh, well, you know, I don't know. I have these stories, but they didn't seem to make an impression on anybody. And she said, well, let me see them. And so I said, okay. And I sent them to her and she said, look, you know, don't get your hopes up. And I said, yes, don't worry, they're not up at all. And she said, but let me see if I can place these stories, or, you know, let me see if I can place some of these individual stories in places that will maybe give you a little bit more visibility. So she took me on with all the caveats. And then what happened when I was in Provincetown was, I mean, it really was a sort of, you know, miraculous year or 7 months, because I then wrote there, I conceived and wrote A Temporary Matter, which is the first story that I place in Interpretive Maladies. And that was my first story that got published in the New Yorker magazine. And that all happened when I was at Provincetown. And I think once that story was published in the New Yorker magazine, then the book had more of the manuscript. There was suddenly, oh, and plus there's this bonus story that was published in the New Yorker. And then, so then the manuscript became a book.
The Interpretive Maladies won the Pulitzer Prize and was this big success. And I was wondering how you feel about that process now. So we've had various writers on the show who've had these examples of a big success with a debut, Monica Ali, for instance, and they've often talked, with now that a sort of period of time has passed, about actually how complex a process that can be, that you're suddenly thrust very much into the spotlight, that it raises whole questions of what you do next, that there can be feelings of envy and so forth from peers, but also at the same time that it feels like that you're not actually allowed to say any of this because you've had this mega success that everyone would dream about. But I'm, you know, go into this as much as you want, but I'm, you know, this is obviously a while ago now. So with the benefit of perspective, what was good about that experience and what was challenging about it?
It was just, on the whole, it was completely baffling and bewildering, and it felt a mistake to me, you know, sort of some sort of strange joke, you know, how can this possibly be? What do I do with this attention, recognition, and all of the things you just mentioned, you know, that come with it? One of which I think was the most painful was a sort of sense of being suddenly separated out from the peer group that you're in, you know, the people that you're kind of in the trenches with as an emerging writer. Which was a wonderful sustaining thing for me to feel that I was, you know, I was slowly developing, you know, step by step, you know, a story here, a story there, now something in the New Yorker, now a book contract. And it was beautiful to have others around me who we were all sort of more or less in that same phase of development, and suddenly a recognition like that just kind of forklifts you out. And that felt, that was very troubling to me and had consequences, most of which I kind of repressed, I think. I mean, I think my strategy was was basically to pretend it didn't happen and to be very diffident about the whole thing. I think the thing that I am grateful for regarding the Pulitzer, the thing that I'm most grateful for is that it gave me opportunities to travel, and it brought my work into other languages. You know, so that the consequence of receiving a big prize like that is that it's in everybody's, you know, the world is sort of watching, and it gets on people's radar outside of the world, you know, in my case, outside of the Anglosphere. That remains to me sort of bewildering in a wonderful way, just only with gratitude that the fact that my book was then translated into so many languages. In fact, the Italian rights were bought for my book before the Pulitzer, which strikes me now in retrospect. But there were so many more opportunities to go to places, and one of the places I began to go as an author was Italy. And part of the complex motivation of you know, sort of learning Italian and so on, was some of it was born from finding myself in Italy and frequently sort of being in a situation where I'm on a stage or at a table or whatever, and people are asking me questions and there's an interpreter, because of course back then I don't know how to speak Italian, and it's the sort of unconscious or eventually increasingly conscious desire to not have the interpreter figure, to be able to speak for myself in that language, to be able to answer for myself and to express myself and to explain myself in Italian as a writer. This was one of the things that was motivating me, I think, eventually when I really intensified my study of the language.
In terms of following up after that sort of massive hit, did it help that you had the germs of, you know, the namesake already sort of moving around in your head when it then came to producing your next work?
I mean, I had the germs of all of my books very early on. I had The Lowland, I had The Namesake, I had stories, I had sort of stubs of stories, ideas in Unaccustomed Earth. I had all of this stuff. All of this stuff was stockpiling even before I went to Provincetown. So when I was still kind of in my graduate school phase in Boston, all of the first four books that I wrote in English, they all were germinating in different, you know, little, there were sort of petri dishes in my head of these ideas, stories, plot lines. They were all there, and it was just a matter of moving through the years from book to book, from project to project, in order to allow those ideas to really emerge and be articulated.
It's a rule of the podcast that we always ask about money and how it interacts with people's lives. So be as candid or as guarded as you're comfortable here, but how, you know, during your career as a novelist, has the financial side worked, and where have these university teaching roles fitted into that as well?
Well, I mean, in the beginning, of course, you write and there's no compensation whatsoever, and you write because you have to write, and you write because it's a calling. And I still feel that that is the state of mind with which I approach my creativity, as if I were, you know, still in graduate school and writing stories during like an academic holiday because I have some extra time. That said, you know, I must acknowledge, of course, that I eventually was compensated for my work. You know, so you publish a story in a small literary magazine, maybe you get $200, and you publish a story in the New Yorker magazine and you get $4,000. I mean, it's a big leap, right? It's suddenly, oh my God. And similarly with book advances and that kind of thing. I mean, my first book advance was relatively modest, right, for two books. And then my book won the Pulitzer Prize, and suddenly the advance for the next two books is much more generous because the expectations are, you know, ratcheted sky high. that they will be able to, everything I write will be able to say winner of the Pulitzer Prize on the cover to attract a reader. But there's a price to pay for the writer who accepts, you know, large sums, because then I feel clearly the sort of capitalist reality of what this all means, you know, and that you're in a business and you're providing a product that the business wants to sell and make profit out of. This is all very, very clear in publishing and in, you know, sort of, shall we say now, what has now become corporate publishing, right? For me, you know, the move into Italian comes with accepting a different kind of compensation for my work. So I sort of experienced an interesting parabola, shall we say. So, you know, first two books, nobody knew who I was. Let's be conservative. Let's offer sort of this modest sum and see what happens. The next two books, oh my God, Pulitzer Prize winner. Let's offer her all of this money because, you know, now she's big name. And then with the move into Italian and a different type of approach in my writing, different kinds of work that is against the current, against all the expectations of who I am, who people think I am, what people think I should be writing about, the compensation is again in a different place. And many people say, oh, well, you were so happy in Italy, why didn't you just stay there, you know? And the answer is partly a financial one, because the university appointments, first at Princeton, now at Barnard, liberate me from the cycle, to sort of from the whole kind of, you know, capitalist reality behind being a published author. And, you know, the figure of the advance and the number of books sold and how many copies sold and do you earn out and do you not earn out, and, you know, that whole reality, which is a reality. And I feel that, you know, by having an academic position and earning a different kind of salary for a different kind of labor, I have been able to write things without thinking about, you know, is this book going to be received well? Is it going to go over well? Is it going to sell? I mean, I never think about, oh, is it going to sell? But even critically, you know, what are people going to make of it? Are people just going to scratch their heads? Are people going to think it's ridiculous? I don't think about it in the same way, because I don't need it to perform. I don't need it to perform the way that, say, my publishers would clearly hope it performs. And this whole word I find so deeply alienating when people say, oh, this book performed, overperformed, underperformed. This is a very strange term, I think, to use when talking about the books I write, which I write because I feel the deep need to write them. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful that someone believes in them enough to spend the time helping me to, you know, edit them and copy edit them and choose a jacket and, you know, distribute it to a bookstore or to a library. That's incredible for me. But that's sort of also enough for me. And then the rest of it, the less I think about it, the saner I am and the more productive I am. And I think the more integrity I maintain as an artist.
We're coming towards the end of our time, so as a final question from me, I wanted to ask about the influence of Leslie Epstein, who you studied creative writing with. You've said in previous interviews that he's sort of taught you to identify the elements that were failing in a text and then to work through them. Could you briefly sort of say, you know, how that's changed your creative writing process?
Well, it was fundamental. Meeting him was fundamental because he was the first person who believed in me as a writer. And that's a huge thing. I mean, the first person in the universe who says, you're a writer. When you don't believe you're a writer, you don't dare call yourself a writer, but someone else who is a writer says, you know, you are a writer. And his encouragement in those years that I was on the surface an academic was, it's impossible for me to explain the value of that. But he would say, don't forget you're also a writer. And it was very easy to forget. And it's still very easy to forget that I'm a writer sometimes because I do other things. I mean, right now I'm teaching full-time at university and I haven't written in months and months and months. It's, you know, life is a complicated thing and we make choices and we have so much going on. And, you know, a writer is someone who writes. And there have been long phases of my life where I have not written, have not been able to write for because of other obligations or other situations, circumstances. But to the question of failure, I mean, I think, you know, it's the Beckettian line, you know, that we all know. It's fail better. I mean, that's what you're doing. You're trying things out. Every story, every attempt is an attempt. It's not perfect. There's something you get and there's something you don't. And you use that, you know, to go on to the next venture.
And so a final question from me, I wanted to return to the idea of learning Italian that we started with. And I found this really fascinating because I'd been working a lot on my French and my German for my current book project. And I was reading the New Yorker piece you wrote about it. And I was struck that it seemed that kind of, at least at the beginning, you were approaching this in quite an academic way. You bought a textbook, you then had lessons and so forth. And I was wondering, did you ever just have a chance to completely immerse yourself in an Italian-speaking environment? And I was wondering, you know, given you've got a family and things like that, how that worked. Did you ever have a chance just to say, you know, I'm only, beyond just reading in Italian, I'm only going to exist in Italian for X months and see what happens?
Well, of course, I moved to Rome. I moved my entire family to Rome.
What language did you speak at home?
I spoke English with my family, but that was it. I didn't speak English at all. And I speak very little English when I'm in Italy. I mean, almost my entire life there is in Italian. So, you know, I mean, but that was the critical moment of realizing, you know, I had to be in the place and surround myself with the language. So when we moved to Rome in 2012, that was my mission, and that was what I did. And I spoke in Italian, I wrote in Italian, I read only in Italian. But I was already sort of preparing myself for that before I left the United States. And then, of course, in Italy, Italian completely takes over my life, takes over my writing life, takes over my psyche. And now, you know, all these years later, I'm trilingual, I suppose, but I feel that, you know, I speak Italian every day. I have an entire life in Italy that is an ongoing quotidian part of my day-to-day life in the United States as well, because a part of me is now living in Italian. And, you know, vital parts of my life are unfolding in, you know, constantly in Italian, from telephone calls, text messages, emails, what have you. So this is like, there's no more need in that way to be immersed because it is already inside of me, you know, it's already inside. But that was, of course, a process.
Great. Well, look, thank you very much, and wishing you all the best with both this book and your other projects going forward.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
That was the Always Take Notes interview with Jhumpa Lahiri. She is not on social media and doesn't have a website, but Roman Stories is published by Picador. Hello, it's us again. Simon, what was your takeaway from the interview with Jhumpa?
I enjoyed speaking to her. I'd actually kind of come across her work before we got in touch with her for the podcast, because I read her short story, Peace Parties, in the New Yorker, I think last summer, and I found it very powerful and very beautiful. She was not a writer that I'd come across previously, so sort of interesting to come to someone anonymously through their work for me. And I think the other thing that I found very interesting was this idea of learning a language eventually to the level of being able to write in it, because with the project I've been working on at the moment, I've been spending a lot of time working on and immersing myself in French and German, but almost exclusively with a target of speaking and reading. So, you know, writing is another game altogether, and really interesting to hear her thoughts on that. What about you, Rachel?
Yes, very much so. I mean, the idea, as someone who's got very dodgy French, of writing another language is impressive and incomprehensible to me. Yeah, I enjoyed the conversation. I also appreciated the detail that she went into regarding the publication of Interpreter of Maladies, and, you know, how she got to the the point where she considered herself a writer. So I thought that was valuable and engaging. What have you been up to, Simon?
I'm still in the mountains for my book project. As I was saying off air at the weekend, I did the first preparatory race for this ski mountaineering race that I'm doing in April. So it was an event called the Alpini Ski, which I did with my partner for the project, a guy called Will Tysak. And it's quite demanding. We had to climb 2,300 meters on skis. But the training I'd done paid off. And it was just a kind of completely novel and kind of quite weird experience with lots of people dressed up in lycra onesies and stuff like that. But we survived it, which was good. What about you, Rachel?
I have been working on a piece about cute and cuteness and how it's taken over the world. Obviously, extremely arduous research involved. And I've been watching the Six Nations documentary on Netflix. Even for those who don't know rugby's rules, I would recommend it. It's more about the personalities of the coaches and players involved. So in the kind of docu-series, sports docu-series, extended universe these days, rugby is now part of it, but it's enjoyable.
I'm also actually a fan of those documentaries, having watched the Tour de France one last year, which I knew very little about professional cycling, but found it kind of fascinating way into that. So it's clearly a boom segment. Anyway, this has been Always Take Notes, hosted by me, Simon Aikam.
And me, Rachel Lloyd.
Our producer and social media editor is Artemis Irvin. Our score is by Jess Danheiser. And our graphic design is by James Edgar.
If you'd like to follow us on social media, we're on Twitter at Take Notes Always, on Instagram at Always Take Notes. If you'd like to support us on our crowdfunding page on Patreon, we're on there under Always Take Notes. And if you'd like to leave a review on iTunes or get in touch with us via our website, please do.
Many thanks. Goodbye.